Understood.
The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Thomas M. Harris presiding.
Good morning. This is case number 4-23-0592, City of Eureka versus Knobloch. Counsel, could we have appearances first for the appellant?
Yes, Bert Dancy with Elif Dancy and Bosich for the appellant Jerry Knobloch.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Jeffrey Gaster of Miller Hall and Triggs for the City of Eureka.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Dancy, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court. I don't know why that I'm more uncomfortable over the over Zoom than I am in person. I think it's the old fashioned way of doing it. But we are here and I appreciate the availability. I have four main points that I'd like to make with respect to this case. The first one is I think there's little or no prejudice to the City of Eureka if Mr. Knobloch is given his day in court. And there's $330,000 worth of prejudice to Mr. Knobloch if he doesn't get to defend himself with respect to this building. The second point is that from the beginning, the penalty simply astounded me and shocked me for alleged building code violations. I work as corporation counsel from the firm for the City of Pekin for many years and did OV prosecutions in Tazewell County. And the purpose was to get compliance or to cover the costs of the city having to undertake compliance through outside contractors. And here there's no rational or reasonable relationship to that second goal.
Mr. Dancy, instead of discussing the merits of the underlying case, could we turn to the elements required under a 214-01 petition, which is due diligence and a meritorious defense? And maybe you could start with the meritorious defense. You seem to indicate a concession below that you didn't plead one.
I think I pled it, but I pled it softly, if you will. I had Mr. Knobloch was a difficult guy to talk to. I had found out, I went over with him. He indicated he'd made a number of improvements to the property, that he got some of the junk out. Some of it went to the scrap people. Some of it just went to the junk. Some of it was recyclable. And he indicated to me that. And when I filed mine, my affidavit, and I'll search it, indicated that he had evidence which contradicted the deficiencies that alleged in the property as to their seriousness, as well as to the substance and the timing of repairs.
Now, is pleading that you have evidence the same as pleading the facts?
It is not, sir. If I would do it again, I would certainly have him more detailed what that evidence was. Although I think, under the circumstances, with the $330,000 fine, I think that plays into all aspects of it, Your Honor. I can't disagree that I wish I had his affidavit as to what he had done. Instead, I had his assurance that he did it.
Mr. Dancy, Appley indicates in its brief in a footnote that there was not a request made following the dismissal to replead. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate.
Okay.
I'll go back. And if you look at when I was going over the complaint, it seemed to me that you could have pled what they pled in four, five, or six counts. We have a nuisance. We have junk and debris in count three. We have tarps, buckets, and debris in count two. We have a propane tank in count 10. We have lumber, junk, and debris in 11. We have fence posts in 14, tarps in 15, extension cords in 19, boxes, plywood, and posts in 17, a mower deck in 18, more blocks in 20. So all of it is a nuisance. They seem to have enumerated 11 counts, which are very similar. It's all one nuisance. And the result is that my client is tacked with a fine of $330,000, $15,000 per the maximum per violation for matters that would have cost the city very little in cleaning them up.
Councilor, if I may, just procedurally, though, this is not an issue of merits that was reached. I mean, you filed a 214-01, and then in response, they filed a 2615 motion to dismiss, correct?
That is correct.
So the order being appealed is the trial court's granting of that motion to dismiss. So wouldn't you agree that those would be different standards of review for this court?
I think there's different standards of review, which is why my argument went to the unfairness of the penalty under a modified plain error doctrine or under 366. It just seems to me that the enormity of the penalty and the lack of notice, the notice that a default was at issue was filed the day before the hearing. There was a change in the nature of the default. No notice was given, and no subsequent notice was given till after the 30 days had expired through the citation to discover assets. So the plaintiff switched the hearing at the last moment without adequate notice to Mr. Knobloch, and then didn't send any notice of the default to him.
Isn't there default language in a summons that says if an answer isn't filed within a specified date, that a default may be taken against you? Isn't that essentially what happened?
It is in the summons, but he was given a subsequent order that said the next date was for status.
How was he prejudiced? How was he prejudiced by being given more time?
How was he? Pardon me, sir.
How was he prejudiced by being given more time to answer?
He wasn't prejudiced. He was prejudiced because it said status and not default. And that leads me to the fourth aspect of my argument, which is we are dealing with.
Go ahead. That was some.
Okay. We are dealing with a client. And I think it was it is apparent in speaking with Jerry Knobloch that he is a very limited capacity with respect to language and language understanding and cognitive abilities in the language realm. So
Mr. Dancy, that kind of brings up another issue here, and that is the due diligence. You filed your appearance on June 15th. There had already been a memorandum or a entry of judgment by that point. How is it that nothing got done for quite so long until after the citation was issued?
Because it was the citation that alerted him and I that anything had happened previously.
But you have some obligation. You file an appearance in a case. You didn't check what had happened. You've already said you had a client who was having these mental difficulties. You couldn't rely on him for the information. So how is that reasonable?
My client had, in part because of his disability, kept all the paperwork. So it wasn't this case, but three other cases that he brought to me. And he was very thorough in his note-taking and the paperwork. And I didn't check the electronic record. I relied on thorough paperwork that my client provided, and there was no notice of default in any of his paperwork. So the first notice either one of us had, actual notice, was after the 30 days had run. And as soon as we'd got that, I filed the 214-01. And I guess I'm aware. That I would do it differently in retrospect. And if the fine here were a normal fine and related to the nature of the offenses, I would not be making the 366 and the plain error arguments. That's the reason those are the principal reliance in the brief. And that is because the degree of punishment is totally unrelated to any burden on the village of Eureka. In 30 years of working for the city and doing ordinance violations, I don't think I ever saw an award more than $10,000. And here it's confiscatory. They're essentially taking his building and then some for limited violations. And so when it happened, I thought it was shocking. I thought it essentially shocked the conscience. And because of the penalty, it needed to be overturned. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dancy. You'll have time in rebuttal if you would like. Mr. Gasser, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor and counsel, and may it please the court. Again, Jeffrey Gasser for the City of Eureka. We're here on an order granting the city's motion to dismiss pursuant to 2615, the petitioner's 214-01 petition. That order was correct, and it should be affirmed. Just to give a brief roadmap of why we requested oral argument in this case, because on the merits of 214-01, this strikes me as a pretty straightforward case. But there was a little bit of a interesting dispute between the parties on the appropriate standard of review, based on the circuit court kind of going a little bit beyond the pleadings on the diligence analysis. And so we wanted to be able to provide an opportunity to clear up any confusion that might have been going on with that, because there's portions of the court's analysis that didn't quite smack of a 2615. Having said that, I am going to start with the basic elements of a 214-01 petition. As the court has already alluded to, there has to be an allegation supported by facts of a meritorious defense. And then there has to be factual allegations that would for diligence in the underlying proceeding, as well as diligence in bringing forth the 214-01 petition. So starting with meritorious defense, and this is the easiest way to resolve the case on a basic garden variety 2615 analysis without getting into any of the weird standard of review issues that arose on the due diligence prong. As this court has repeatedly explained, the pleading burden for a meritorious defense, it's not sufficient for the petition and any supporting affidavits to just assert that there is a meritorious defense without also, this is a quote, without also pleading the relevant facts supporting the alleged offense. And that comes from the McGraw case that we cite in our brief. To the contrary, the petition has to allege affirmative allegations of fact, which, if taken as true, would establish the existence of a claimed defense. The petitioner cannot rely on conclusory statements that I have, you know, defense A or defense B, or as in this case, the petition really just says I have a defense, and it's essentially a general denial of the allegations. I'm going to mispronounce the pronunciation of this case, but we cited in our brief the Lamoureux versus Havranek case. I actually had the site wrong. It's 25 Illap 2nd 51. This is a case involving the Civil Practice Act before 214.01, but it's very similar. It's a short opinion. The appellate court, in their recitation of the facts, says, you know, all the petition alleged is that there was a defense. Didn't get into the details, no supporting factual allegations. And in, you know, two or three short pages, the court makes quick work of that petition and actually reverses the circuit court had granted the petition. The appellate court says, no, you can't just say I have a defense and leave it at that. Here, the petition is quite the same. We have an allegation that the petitioner thinks he has evidence that would defeat the city's claims. We don't know what the evidence is. We don't know how much of the evidence exists. We don't, you know, think of the five W's, who, what, where, when, why. We don't know anything about this evidence. We don't even know if it's, you know, admissible. And, you know, obviously in the summary judgment context, you can't defend against summary judgment by citing admissible evidence. So, you know, at the 2615 stage, to try to game out if there's been sufficient factual allegations, I think you would certainly need to know what the facts are so you can at least make some threshold determination about admissibility and where the case is going to go after the pleadings. And here we just don't have it. All we have is, as the Molden court would put it, we have a gratuitous allegation that there's a defense without any supporting factual allegations. And, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. There was a lengthy colloquy in the circuit court between the judge and petitioner's counsel, where the counsel stated, we allege a meritorious defense. And the judge said, okay, where are the facts setting forth that that would enable me to, quote, make a finding? And counsel says, there, quote, there were no facts set forth. He goes on to explain, you know, that he, you know, didn't think it was necessary. But I mean, there's no better authority on the paucity of the pleading than petitioner's counsel himself, who admitted in the circuit court, and I believe even this morning, that there were no factual allegations to support that meritorious defense. And on the waiver, you know, there was never a request during the hearing to amend the petition. There was never a motion to modify or clarify or seek leave to amend after the circuit court ruled in this case. Instead, the petitioner's counsel stood on the pleadings as they existed by going straight to the appellate court. So the pleadings, these deficits that we've identified, those are locked in, and he hasn't sought any relief to reopen the pleadings. The petitioner is seeking, you know, he wants the court to basically grant the petition so we can reopen the underlying ordinance violation cases. So that's 2615. That's very straightforward. You know, everything that I'm about to say from here on is just window dressing, because on a 2615, we have multiple admissions that there weren't factual allegations pleaded. That's enough to end the case.
Can I ask you just a couple of questions?
Please.
On the 24th of May, you filed a motion for default and you served it by mail. Mm-hmm. First of all, why file a motion and a notice, and why do it the day before the hearing?
It's a great question. This is the honest answer. The partner who filed the motion ordinarily does not do ordinance violation cases. He took it over. there was some attrition in our firm, and the case needed to be handled. And I think that,
but you don't need experience in ordinance cases to know that you give notice of a motion,
right,
with 2 days' service under the rules.
A little unusual. What I will say is that under Rule 572 and 575, the motion was completely unnecessary, because the 572, the admonition that we include in the summons, it states that if the defendant doesn't appear on the date directed under for first appearance, or on any subsequent date that the court says, "Hey, come to court," you can be defaulted without further notice. So you're certainly correct. If this was a more typical case, like a breach of contract or a tort case, and if we snuck in a motion like this, I think there'd be a huge problem. But I think because of the way Rule 572 and 575 work, the motion wasn't necessary. And so there simply can't be any prejudice in any sense of the word, be it from due process or any principle of fundamental fairness.
What about, because I know that this is a civil action and the civil rules do still apply where they're not overruled by something more specific, but what about Section 213.02, which says on the entry of an order of default, the attorney for the moving party shall immediately give notice to the party who's appeared.
Right. And, you know, during the hearing, if I understood petitioner's counsel, during the hearing in the circuit court, I believe he disclaimed any reliance on the failure to send that subsequent notice. And to further respond, this is where, you know, while it's a little bit unusual and maybe unnecessary for us to send that notice of motion, I think that actually cuts both ways, because there's no allegation that the petitioner did not receive the motion or receive the notice. He's just alleging that he didn't get it in time. But if he got the motion, you know, the day after, there's nothing stopping him from contacting the circuit clerk to say, "Hey, I thought this was up for status. Now I'm finding out that there might have been a motion for default. I need to investigate this further to confirm if that order was entered." And had that been done, we would be well within the time frame, I believe under 213.02 or 213.03, to timely move to set aside that default judgment. It's important for the court to read between the lines and focus not just on what the petitioner is alleging, but what he's not alleging. He never says that those mailings didn't get to him. He just says he didn't get it in time, and that therefore we, quote, switched the nature of the hearing. And, you know, on that point, we cite the city of Joliet versus, it's another name I can't pronounce, Sizana, where, you know, this exact situation happened. There was the defendant actually was participating more than the petitioner here. The defendant had filed a motion to dismiss. There was a problem with how that got noticed up. So the court set it for another hearing. Defendant doesn't show up. Court sets it again for status. Defendant doesn't show up. And on the court's own initiative, there was no motion in that case. The court just says, "All right, she's not here. You know, we're defaulting her." And the appellate court, citing the 572 and 575, says that's not a problem because the admonitions say if you don't show up when you're told to, you can be defaulted. I hope that answers the court's question.
Yeah. Just final question. I know that defendant's counsel has talked about the size of the fine, which really goes to the merits of the case. And really, there's no circumstance that we would be looking at the merits. But just because I know from having presided over cases like this in the circuit court that municipalities often trade fines for compliance. Have you expressed any willingness to discuss that with your opposing counsel?
You know, when this petition, as the petition in the circuit court was being filed and briefed, the court might note there's kind of a big gap between petition being filed and then finally getting heard on our motion. There were discussions with, you know, maybe the building being turned over as, and then we call it square. I don't think the fair market value of the building is going to come anywhere close to approaching the value of the fines. And then that would enable the city to get in, clean it up. The violations that we were dealing with here, again, I don't want to get too into the merits, but we're talking, you know, people living in kind of like an industrial storage type building, you know, utilities not connected. So we're bringing in water from hoses, all the issues that you would think of with human waste and sanitation.
Yeah, I didn't mean to invite a discussion of those details. I just, you know, court is always an opportunity to express a party's willingness to achieve an outcome that might be more mutually advantageous. And I wanted to see if you'd maybe take advantage of that opportunity.
And my policy is I never say no to a settlement discussion, even if my client is not too willing. And I'm not suggesting that the city is not too willing in this case, but I'll never say no to at least picking up the phone.
Thank you.
Council, just for a matter of clarification, you mentioned and you state in your brief, you agree with regards to the motion to dismiss that the de novo standard of review is appropriate. You mentioned in your earlier comments, though, you also set forth at least some argument with regards to the manifest weight. I assume that was directed to the due diligence findings, what I will say, post pleadings with regards to the time gap from when the entry of appearance was filed and the motion was heard and the court's references there. Am I accurate in that?
That's correct. The court had a colloquy with petitioner's counsel regarding, you know, what happened when we've sent the turnover motion, and then that triggered all these things started happening. And petitioner's counsel had entered his appearance on June 16th. The default order was entered on May 25th. So at that time, there was still 6 days left on the clock to file a timely motion to vacate in the circuit court. And, you know, the circuit court's questions to petitioner's counsel about, you know, why didn't you check the docket? What was going on? That sort of went beyond the pleadings. And so, yeah, that's the portion of the court's analysis that if there's going to be a bifurcated standard of review, I think the circuit court has kind of told us where it's thinking. If this gets, you know, remanded for more, you know, proceedings, the court's already determined that diligence cannot be shown based on counsel's failure to check the docket and figure out what was going on. So that question that Your Honor just asked, that essentially that's, you know, the 30-second elevator speech analysis for, you know, diligence. You know, the case law is legion that 214-01 petition, it's not an opportunity for a litigant to do what they could have done or should have done in the proceeding below. It's not an opportunity to excuse the mistakes or inadvertence or inattention of counsel. And I'm not trying to be mean or insulting. That's just the nature of this case, is that's just how the analysis goes. I have a lot of respect for petitioner's counsel. We've worked on a lot of cases together, so I'm not trying to be caustic by any stretch, but that's just the nature of this analysis, is there's simply no explanation for counsel's failure to check the docket, especially in the face of a client who, by counsel's own admission, in the affidavit he submitted in support of his petition, counsel states, you know, the petitioner's disabilities are apparent to anyone who interacts with him. You know, the first thing that I certainly would have been doing was going on judiciary or calling the clerk to figure out what was going on. And the circuit court certainly didn't think that was excusable. Whether it's a de novo review or abuse of discretion, in any standard of review, that just can't cut it. So if there's no other questions, the city would ask that the circuit court's judgment be affirmed, applying de novo or abuse of discretion review. the circuit court got it right here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gaster. Mr. Dancy, do you have rebuttal argument?
A brief, Your Honor. We did, as to one of the justices' questions, I did speak with other counsel for the city with respect to settlement. And we made a sizable financial offer, but wanted to keep the building, and it was rejected, and they simply want the building at this point in time. I have consistently raised the issue of the late notice and the total lack of notice of the required notice of the default as part of the problems in this case. And as part of the lack of information given to my client, the way it appropriately should have been given. The notice issues, the lack of notice issues were raised from the beginning with the 1401. And then I would just close by again requesting the court review it from abroad under the 366 or the plain error standard, because of the limited capacity of my client and because of the incredibly unreasonable $330,000 penalty for debris, garbage, hoses, electrical wires. The court has the power to do justice for Mr. Knobloch in terms of the penalty, if nothing else. But that is confiscatory and unrelated to anything that the village would need to clean the property up, which has been, in the interim, it's continued to be improved and brought into compliance, which was the goal of most but apparently not this ordinance violation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dancy. Thank you both. The case will be taken under advisement, and we will issue a written decision.